From WUOT News, this is Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. The most recent edition of the Pew Center's Religious Landscape Survey confirms what other polls have shown in recent years, that Americans are increasingly likely to answer none when asked about their religious affiliation. And while Tennessee and the South in general are more religious than other parts of the nation, fewer people are hanging on to the tenets of that old-time religion. Some of them are redefining what their faith means in a modern context. Today on Dialogue, an examination of faith in Tennessee 2015. Stay with us after an update on this hour's news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Earlier this week, there was an interesting story out of the city of Clarksville, Tennessee, that caught my attention. Pastor Jimmy Terry has ordered thousands of red and white yard signs that read, "Christmas is all about Jesus." He says he's tired of the religious meaning of Christmas and Easter being drowned out by a growing commercial and secular drumbeat. But Pastor Terry's message may be falling on a few more deaf ears these days than in past years. The most recent assessment of religious faith from the Pew Research Center found the number of people with no specific religious affiliation grew between 2007 and 2014. As we enter the holiday season and this hour on Dialogue, we look at how faith is changing in Tennessee. For that, we turn to our two guests today. The Reverend Bruce Spangler is the interim CEO of the Volunteer Ministry Center and the author of a series of books recasting the Bible with an Appalachian twist. The latest is an adaptation of the Book of Job called Jubal. And Dr. Tricia Bruce, Associate Professor of Sociology at Maryville College. Her specialties include studying the demographics of religion. Last month, she presented a study on Catholic populations at a National Conference of Bishops in Maryland. Good afternoon to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Well, I want to begin with a bit of a disclaimer here, because religion is a sensitive topic. It's a personal topic. It's something people hold dear. We're not here to write the obituary for faith in Tennessee. In fact, far from it, because Tennessee and the Deep South remain much more religious than other parts of the country, in terms of the numbers and perhaps in terms of the fervor as well. 8 in 10 Tennesseans identify with some form of Christianity, according to this Pew Research Center poll, which was accurate to November of this year. More than half of Tennesseans are considered evangelical Protestants in particular. So, Dr. Bruce, I want to begin with you, since you study the demographics, the people numbers of religion. What stands out to you in Tennessee from this 2014 assessment of religion in the state?
As we look at some of the changes that have happened in religion nationally and also specifically in Tennessee, one of the things that folks have had their eyes on has had to do with the growth of those who are unaffiliated. So you mentioned a moment ago, for example, that 81% of adults in Tennessee still affiliate as Christian, identify as Christian. But there is a growing number, both in Tennessee and in the U.S. at large, of those who claim no particular affiliation. And sociologists also have called this group the nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Right, to differentiate them from the nuns that are quite religious.
That's right. And in Tennessee, 14% of Tennessee adults in 2014 identified as having no particular religious affiliation. And that compares to about 22% nationally.
Yeah. Well, before we pile on millennials, that's an easy thing to do. Millennials, by the way, are those defined as being born in around 1984 into about the mid-90s or so. They get blamed for everything wrong with the nation these days, so I don't want to do that. But I want to point out that, at least here in Tennessee, the number of people ages 18 to 29 that are defined as millennials, identified as some form of Christian, actually went up between 2007, that's the last time this survey was done, and 2014, just last year. And that seems to contradict or fly in the face of the conventional wisdom that younger people tend to be less religious. And that does seem to be the case, at least nationally. Now, Dr. Bruce, what do you think might explain that? What are some of the factors that may explain why Tennessee's young people are behaving in a manner different than we might see nationally?
Well, we always have to pay attention to social context and influence. And clearly, being in the South, there are some patterns of behavior and cultural influence of religion that you see at higher levels than you see somewhere, for example, in Vermont, where the percentage of unaffiliated is more than a quarter. We do have to pay attention to the generational trends, though, because overall, the patterns that we're seeing are that lower levels of religiosity and religious affiliation experienced among millennials, among Generation X, are exhibiting some form of generational replacement for those higher levels of religiosity occurring among older generations. So this is something both in terms of the state and also national patterns that we might see continuing to fuel this rise in unaffiliation.
Well, Bruce Spengler, I want to turn to you now and get your thoughts on this as well, as somebody who is pretty deeply involved in religion and its different forms, not just inside the church but out in the community. Talk to me about the trends you're observing, faith in Tennessee in this community.
Sure. I was somewhat reflective of Dr. Bruce's comments about the millennials in terms of being non-affiliated and wondering if the emergent church that we begin to see, I know it as a Southern phenomenon. I don't know across the country, but that becomes a place where, I mean, diverse opinions, diverse doctrinal conclusions, experiences find a common home. And I'm just wondering, is that across the country as well?
Yeah, where we're seeing most growth definitely is coming from those kinds of non-traditional congregational forms. The other interesting thing that we have to remember, too, about the unaffiliated is that even though they're not claiming a formal religious affiliation, that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't consider themselves religious or spiritual, or that they don't have patterns of behavior that look religious and spiritual in terms of prayer, meditation, sense of wonder, and so forth. And so I think part of what's happening is that religious congregations and places of worship are having to respond in creative ways to meet new needs and desires that look a little bit less brick and mortar than they used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to turn back to you, Bruce, for just a minute. You mentioned the emergent church, and I'm not familiar with this term. Tell me more about this. Give us a definition for folks like myself and our listeners who may not be as familiar with it.
Well, I probably will show my ignorance in terms of that because I'm quite older than both of you.
We're not going to hold that
right
against you.
But what I know of the emergent church, I think that Marcus Borg, the New Testament scholar, said that that its approach to the Bible understands it both or in three ways: as history, as metaphor, but also as sacrament. But the Christian life is really just one of transformation and quite relational, and so. I think the biggest expression that I would know of is I believe it's called the Wild Goose Festival in North Carolina, which is an annual event of about 3 or 4 days, if not longer. And I'm sure that the listeners would know more about it than I do. But some, you know, Phyllis Tickle, Natalie Bowles, Weber, those kinds of folks have been very prominent. And even, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, Shane Claiborne has its roots. I don't know if you know Shane. He's been very outspoken relative to the issue of capital punishment, but kind of lives an intentional urban monastic kind of life, but who is actually from Maryville. But he has been an author. But he kind of represents that kind of trend as well. But in the community, and by all means, my views are my views, and I'm here not representing the Volunteer Ministry Center, but the issue of faith and the expression of faith at the center plays a big role, a big role.
Well, that gets us to a related subject here. Again, these are national results. I want to go back to the national part of the Pew result, Pew survey here. 27% of millennials, that's nearly 3 in 10 of these younger people we're talking about, say they attend religious services on a weekly basis. But older adults, it's more half and half. It's closer to 50%. And only about 4 in 10 millennials, that's 40%, say religion is very important in their lives, and that compares with more than half in older generational groups. Now, and again, I want to branch off something that Dr. Bruce said just a moment ago, where she said that doesn't necessarily mean they're irreligious. It doesn't mean that they're not believers. Maybe they're defining their faith very differently. And so, Dr. Bruce, how might younger people be defining their faith or embracing it or living it in a way that may look unfamiliar to older people?
Right. There are a couple ways to think about that. You know, sociologists have written about trying to do a better job of understanding everyday religion and the ways in which people are creatively and meaningfully finding a place for religion, both in their own lives, but also living that out in the public sphere. I think oftentimes, certainly as sociologists, we're tempted to look for things that are lost where the light shines. You know, it's easier to look where the light is shining, but in fact, the dark spots may be where we might find it. And so if we get more creative with our methods, we can begin to see, especially among younger folks, how exactly they're experiencing religion. But I think it's also tied to a couple other larger trends. One is that institutional suspicion is not just relegated to the religious sphere. You know, we
That's
see
right.
millennials also having skepticism of other kinds of institutions, whether it's in terms of politics or education or otherwise. And so this is has a carryover effect into their hesitancy to join congregations or other religious affiliations. And then also there's a question of labeling in the sense that, you know, if we look at earlier trends around religion, folks who said that religion was not important to them or less important to them would still affiliate. You know, they would still say, I am XYZ, but that's not important. And now, perhaps given a reduction in stigma or cultural change, people who are in those camps of saying religion is less important to them are more willing to simply say, I'm unaffiliated.
Right, right. It's to them a better designation than trying to fit themselves into a particular box, yeah, or a precept. And Bruce, what do you think about that? I want to hear your thoughts on this as well.
Well, I think at the moment I'm kind of reflecting on the how diverse my community has become, because in some ways we've talked in quite context in terms of the Christian experience.
Right.
But I live out in East Knox County at the Straw Plains exit, and there is a huge Hindu temple. Just a beautiful, beautiful building, and I think about my community of how that it has embraced such a diverse expression of faith for us. And so, and also my brothers and sisters who are of the Muslim faith, you know, as opposed to just kind of being here on the campus, in the diversity here in the campus, it begins to spread throughout all of our community.
Yes. And actually, that's a good point. Dr. Bruce, did you want to jump in there?
I would just add also that levels of religious affiliation and participation are higher among first-generation and second-generation immigrants than they are among third-generation and beyond. And so especially as we see the United States change demographically, both in terms of migration but also in terms of race and ethnicity as it moves towards a majority-minority nation, then that too is going to impact these patterns in the long term.
The thing I wanted to say is that Bruce Spengler is exactly right, that while we have been talking more about religion from a Christian experience, that is the majority religion in Tennessee. Evangelical Protestantism is the majority, 52%, but certainly not the only. 6% of the state's adults are Catholic, 1% Mormon, 1% Jehovah's Witnesses, and non-Christian faiths that include Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and other world religions, about 3%. So I do want to make sure we get that out there as well, that while most of our discussion today may revolve around a Judeo-Christian sort of background, it's because that's what most people practice in the state, certainly not the only religion that is practiced in the state. We are going to pause for a station break at this point, and when we come back, we're actually going to open the phone lines to all of you, 974-5050. And with kind of a targeted appeal here, because what I'd like to know is maybe your faith has redefined over the last few years. Maybe you're questioning the way you used to worship, or maybe you're worshiping in a different way than your parents' or grandparents' generation. If you have a story like that or a question for our panel, we'd love to hear from you again when we come back from this station break at 19 minutes past the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Back now with Dialogue. It's about 20 minutes after the hour, and thank you so much for joining us. If you are just tuning in, our subject this week is the State of Faith in Tennessee 2015. We're looking at some new numbers from the Pew Center for Research on the American Religious Landscape Survey. They talked to people all over the country, including here in Tennessee, and came up with some interesting conclusions about how faith is evolving in the country. Again, our phone lines are open at 974-5050. Before we went to the break, Dr. Bruce and Bruce Spengler, we were talking about how younger people define their faith. I want to point out something that actually was very interesting from some of the older generations in the Tennessee portion of this Pew survey. While we saw the number of people 18 to 29 who identify themselves as Christian go up between 2007 and 2014, the percentage of people who were 30 to 49, middle-aged folks who identified as Christian, actually contracted. That shrunk. Dr. Bruce, what might explain that? Is that simply a way of counting the numbers, or are we seeing a real change in that group?
I think this is a great question, and might be one that we don't have full answers to mm-hmm. yet. I mean, clearly there's an age effect in terms of going through the life course. People tend to have higher levels of religious participation once they're married, especially once they have kids and as they age. But this is a pattern that seems to be breaking that a little bit. So I think what will be interesting to watch is, especially for that slightly younger millennial group, if that pattern holds, if their religiosity also dips, or if, in fact, we see their levels of religiosity go up. You know, if we look at the unaffiliated, for example, they are less likely to be parents. So, you know, to the extent that family also figures into those religious behaviors, we can be paying attention to that, too.
All right, well, let's take our first call. We're going to turn to Jessica in Knoxville. Jessica, you're on Dialogue. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of speak to the difference in worship that maybe my parents' generation has and versus mine, which is I'm a millennial. So my question was, do you think that social media and maybe the like non-traditional congregation, like where we actually meet, has kind of shaped that? And if you wanted community kind of 50 years ago, you would go to a church building, whereas now, like, I can, you know, get on Instagram or get all these other platforms and kind of find my community without having to actually physically be with my Christian community.
Okay, let's take that to our panel. That's a great question, Jessica. The influence of social media. Boy, that's an influential concept in our society. Everything we get comes from social media now. Our opinions, our news, video, information. Why not matters of faith as well? Dr. Bruce, what do you know about that?
Yeah,
or is this one of those where we need to do some more research?
Both. This is a great question. And I think it's one of the distinctive roles of religion, too, is that especially in the U.S. context, which does have a history of organizing with the use of congregations, you know, these are the one of the few places that create brick and mortar places where you physically come to the same place across lines of difference in terms of age and race and whatnot, and income, although some more than others. But in any case, these are places where you come physically together. And I think your question is a really good one in the sense of, if we look at younger generations, how are they balancing that desire for community and finding creative ways to build community which are less tied to brick and mortar? It does, of course, also link to the particular religious tradition. You know, in Catholicism, which is an area that I study especially, the role of the sacraments is one that ties you indelibly to the building, you know, actually being there. And so that's not something that can be done through social media. And so to the extent that that continues to hold and bring people together, then that will, I think, remain despite the role of social media.
Yeah, I think the other thing that the study does show that only, 50% of the folks actually attend worship once a week.
Right.
And so that kind of cyber church or that cyber worship seems to be a phenomenon. And I think that Robert Putnam probably identified that in Bowling Alone, which was, 25 years ago, thereabouts, where he identified that bowling leagues had diminished in number. At the same time, there were more people bowling individually. And so I think that's probably the same kind of phenomena. Or if I may interject a little humor, you remember Yogi Berra said that if you don't go to someone's funeral, they won't come to yours. And so I'm wondering in terms of that kind of effect, in terms of what does that create culturally?
You know, I should also point out, and this just occurs to me, especially living in this television market, and I'm sure many others across the country, a number of churches have their services televised as well. So we're not living in an era where you necessarily have to go somewhere to get the message. You can get it at home. So very interesting. Aaron in Knoxville, you've been very patient waiting on the line for us. Go right ahead.
Hi, I recently became involved in a little local organization called Sunday Assembly. It's actually an international organization, but there's a local chapter. And it's pretty interesting because a lot of people, when they lose their faith in, you know, the stories and the mythology of their religion or in the institution, they still have the ties to the ceremonies and to the fun things that you get at church, like volunteering or singing or potlucks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunday Assembly is kind of trying to recreate that, but in a secular humanist, you know, philosophy. So without any kind of religious overtones, and it's pretty great. And I think it, you know, it's pretty applicable to the people you're talking about in this program.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for adding that. Yeah, that's really interesting too. Again, talking about something we were just talking about before the break, which is searching for community without necessarily some of the trappings that come along with a definition of religion.
Right, and I think he kind of raises that that idea of the non-religious religious.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some very prominent figures through history, you know, in terms of Dietrich Bonhoeffer talked about kind of a non-religious religious, and I think one of the ones that kind of attracted my attention of late is John Caputo, who is a radical theologian, but who would insist that even in secular life, I mean, it too has a sacred dimension and vice versa. He has this kind of notion that God does not exist, but God insists. And he kind of bases that upon Diderot's the French philosopher who said that justice does not exist, it insists. In other words, that the desire for us as human beings to attach to a meta story or something larger than us,
it
has a constant insistence in our lives. And I think that this study once again shows that whether one is affiliated or not,
that still exists. Yeah. Well, we have one more, and this is Terry in Brewstertown. And Terry, thank you so much for calling in. What's up?
Thank you, Brandon. Yes, I've got a question. With the recent exposures of hundreds of years of men of God of many denominations molesting and or abusing children, screwing their flocks financially and or physically, revealing their hypocrisy and saying they are like pro-life when they're really pro-birth, which provides more victims, what has really religion got to offer, really?
Well, let me take that because I think that's an interesting subject and one that I wanted to address in this show, and we can jump ahead to that as maybe a factor or an engine for disillusionment with people when they see this kind of news coming out, the intersection of politics and religion or the Catholic priest scandals and things like this or malfeasance of church finances and stuff, how that contributes to a disillusionment among people, and who wants to begin with that one? I mean, Dr.
Well, certainly in the Catholic Church, my first book looked at a group of Catholics who mobilized inside the church due to their extreme frustration surrounding the abuse that was occurring there. And but I think one thing that's interesting when you look at a group like that or so many is that, you know, there wasn't the massive exodus that might have been anticipated, even in face of such horrific crimes. And I think it's in part because in the same way that we see this contrast between those who might be hesitant to affiliate, but then still high levels of belief in God, high levels of religious behaviors. And so I think sometimes, especially thinking of religion sociologically, as I do, you know, there's a theological side of it, but there's also a structural side of it. And so there's a skepticism certainly that might arise that has to do more with the structural side of religion.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would add to that is that, goodness, people disappoint people.
Yeah.
And sometimes that disappointment, unfortunately, becomes institutionalized, but people disappoint people.
Well, this gets us into a related question, too, which is maybe some of the other factors, maybe some that are less controversial but more like generational or societal in general, or even personal, that would help us understand why people may turn away from organized religion but still hold on to a personal faith, which we see growing in this country, this idea that I don't necessarily have to belong to a group if I still observe on a personal level. What are some of the factors we've observed that may influence that?
There's certainly structural issues for that, too, in terms of resources and communities that feel comfortable and at home for folks. If you look at the role of congregations broadly defined, you're not just looking at Christian ones, which, by the way, are still quite common. You know, we're talking about those who are unaffiliated in part, but, you know, there are more congregations than there are all top 10 fast food restaurants combined. I mean, this is still an extremely prominent institution in our country, and especially in the South. But in any case, there are ways, too, that people, I think, are combining that more traditional look at what it means to belong with more privatized iterations of religion. Certainly, this is a theme that we've seen in other country contexts. And the U.S. has always been quite rather unique among wealthy nations as for its high levels of religiosity. And yet now, at least in the past few years, we've seen some changes on that front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have a Twitter comment that I wanted to share, too. This one from Joshua Eagle that says, way to go, Aaron, bringing a non-religious viewpoint into dialogue. Glad to hear I'm not alone in Knoxville. Now, and that points out something that maybe you missed. If you're just joining us, at the top of the show, I said we're not really here to be pro or anti, to get you to change your mind about anything. We're here really to explain the whys of why religious faith is shaping up the way it is and how it might be changing over the next several years. So definitely there's a plurality of people in Tennessee that believe or don't believe all kinds of things. And we're seeing that in some of the comments that we're getting online and through some of our callers as well. Let's stay on this topic for a little bit longer, this definition of faith and religious values as a heated subject of debate. For instance, to use a recent example, the arguments that have broken out in the recent weeks over whether or not the U.S. should accept Syrian refugees. And often when I see them, especially on social media, those disagreements are cast in terms of what is or is not a Christian attitude. It's Christian if we do this, or it's not Christian if we do that. Bruce Spengler, give us some insight onto this. People are struggling with how we define our Christianity or belief or non-belief, not just personally, but what it means, how we should behave, right?
Sure. Well, as a full disclosure, you know, I am a United Methodist and ordained in the United Methodist Church. And our church is really struggling with a variety of issues, not necessarily in terms of the Syrian refugees, but in terms of other social issues that we're kind of split on the issue of same-sex marriage, the issue of abortion, and goodness. And so our conversations, or at least in our tradition, we want to talk about Christian conferencing of how that we can be in dialogue. And I think that we end up, I don't know if this to be the case, but in terms of when we begin to couch things, whether it's a Christian response or not, or whether it's the conservative versus the liberal, when we simply talk at each other, we're not talking with each other. And so in some ways, even today, this is a forum that seems to be very inviting just to have a conversation without, to hear the comments from Dr. Bruce are very, very helpful in terms of kind of hearing the structural aspects of it. Goodness, I'm rambling on. I'm going to stop there.
No, I think that's an important point, too. And I think if I'm understanding you correctly, are you saying that it's sort of a minefield when we start evaluating our political, financial, economic decisions, policy decisions on whether or not they reflect the edict of a particular religion?
Right. I mean, because you remember, was it Ramsey that suggested that all Christians should now get gun permits?
That's right. Yeah, Ron Ramsey, the Tennessee Senate Speaker.
Yeah, and I remember reading some of the editorials and the responses to that. I mean, they were broad. They were broad.
But how that
he became, I think the irony for me is that here we have a very high level political figure in our state speaking from not only the Christian perspective, but at least some way of a Christian edict.
Yeah. I think this, to me, is just yet another reminder that religion is certainly not a wholly privatized affair. That, in fact, through both our own individual behaviors, but also through leaders and politicians, religion continues to have a very strong impact in terms of our political affairs. I think one thing that's interesting, too, when you look at some of the data from Pew on some of the changing religious trends has to do with how that intersects with political affiliation. And so, for example, if you compare the Republican Party, those who affiliate as Republican with those who affiliate as Democrat, there is a larger proportion of unaffiliated within the Democratic Party, and there's a larger proportion of evangelical Christians within the Republican Party. And so when you have social issues come up, whether it's, you know, immigration or any other economic issues or otherwise, then religion is clearly going to be helping to frame that conversation.
Okay. I want to turn to another caller now. Lynn in Knoxville has been very patient holding on the line for us. Go right ahead, Lynn.
Yes. Good afternoon to your panel.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to bring about the point that through traditional religions and non-traditional religions or non-denominational, I see that the dialect of the King James Version versus the New Living Translation has a lot to do with the influence of young people attending or recognizing with the religious belief. And I just wanted to hear from the panel if they feel that that is a, probably a determining factor in the loss of those from traditional religious venues to the new non-denominational venues that we see today.
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. We'll turn to Bruce Spangler on that one. I'm not as familiar with specific versions or texts of the Bible. What do you make of that?
Well, there are definitely faith expressions, Christian expressions that believe in only the King James Version, the 1611, and actually build their core community spirit around that. I don't know in terms of, as you mentioned at the beginning of our gathering, I have done some Smoky Mountain versions of some of the biblical Bibles, the biblical books, and I remember sharing it with hopefully some readers, and I remember the reaction to some of my conservative or evangelical brothers and sisters, you know, how dare you take this and mess it up. And so,
interesting.
But anyway, I think that, you know, the scriptures find a variety of community expressions.
Well, this gets to an interesting perspective, too. Like when we talk about, say, a lessening of faith or on the organizational or group level, how much of it might be because we're used to being able to customizing everything else in our lives. This year of 2015, we can pick the TV shows we want to watch on Netflix and when we want to watch them and how often, the music we hear, we can filter our political views that we get through Facebook, and we can sort of create our own media environments. Is it too big a leap of logic to say this also applies to matters of faith, too, that I can sort of, you know, well, I don't really like what this church has to say. I'll go to this one, or I won't, or I'll do this, or I'll find another way.
Sure.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah.
This is absolutely happening. You know, some journalists have called it the big sort. Filter our choices, whether it's in terms of neighborhood or food or politics, but certainly in terms of religion. And this can have powerful effects in terms of who we're building community with. Most churches are monoracial. You know, most churches do not cut across racial lines. Most churches also exhibit strong similarity along lines of class. And so if you're surrounded by others who are similar to you, then that notion of community may not be cutting across lines of difference as it might be intended. Just to pair that with one other theme that's happening in religious institutions, you know, certainly with the example of the Catholic Church, there's a supersizing of parishes, meaning that they're getting larger and larger, and this is driven by a number of factors, including the decline in the number of priests to serve in an individual parish.
So they might be consolidating smaller parishes into larger ones. Yeah.
And certainly in this area, we have a number of mega churches too, and in these you have both the big size effect, supersizing, but then also the use of smaller groups in order to build community amidst such a large one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think it's a postmodern or maybe not even a modern phenomenon. I mean, it's been all a part of history. I mean, as a United Methodist, we were started by John Wesley, who, went against the polity of his church and ordained some folks to come to the United what is now the United States, the colonies at the time. The Reformation, You know, I think the forgive me, but one of the most fascinating groups for me that I've come across through the years is a group of primitive Baptist Universalists in Central Appalachia, who are known as no-hellers, who do not believe in the existence of hell. Change that. They do believe in the existence. Hell is simply what you go through in this life. Came about in the 19th century when a Universalist preacher and a Baptist preacher began to talk with one another.
Yeah.
And just a very interesting expression.
Right. We're going to pause for a station break. Again, we'd like to hear from you. We've got about 20 minutes left in the show. 974-5050. Our guests, Bruce Spangler and Dr. Tricia Bruce, as we discuss the state of faith in Tennessee 2015. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues here on listener-supported public radio, 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and our guest, again, if you're just joining us, some interesting folks talking to us today, Reverend Bruce Spangler, the interim CEO of the Volunteer Ministry Center. He's also the author of a series of books retelling the Bible with an Appalachian twist, the latest of which an adaptation of the Book of Job called Jubal. And Dr. Tricia Bruce, Associate Professor of Sociology at Maryville College. Her specialties include studying the demographics, or the people numbers, of religion. Well, before the break, we were talking about religion in flux and where these different ideas come from and maybe how they shape how people choose paths to religion or even non-belief. And we had somebody earlier who was talking about secular humanism, so I do want to talk about that a little bit. 14% of people in Tennessee identified themselves as non-specifically affiliated. They weren't affiliated with any particular religion, but of that group, or within that group, I should say, 4% consider themselves either atheist or agnostic. And one of our callers a little earlier this hour outlined maybe some of the reasons for that, a disillusionment with church organization or a feeling, and I'm going to get personal here for just a minute, in my case, of unsatisfactory answers from religion. I'm a man of science, and I just don't, you know, the empirical evidence isn't there, and for me, belief is a little bit a bridge too far. That's going to get me some lovely hate mail, I'm sure, but that's okay. That's all right.
Part of the conversation.
You're in good company. You're in good company. Yeah. Carl Sagan said he did not want to just believe. He wanted to know.
Yeah, and that is an important point. We were talking about people's innate desires. You were talking about, and people have argued for years about whether or not there's a species relationship with religion. Like, was that going to be inevitable, that creatures like humans were going to have to generate or believe in something like this because our brains wanted to know more than our senses could tell us, you know? So there is obviously a lot of room for questioning and debate and non-belief. And so I want to talk to you a little bit, Bruce Spangler, about how you communicate with non-believers. In your role as a man of faith, how do you communicate with those folks? What are those conversations like?
Well, I have just as the same level of doubts that you do, Brandon. I mean, in terms of human suffering, in terms of violence and conflict and why certain things happen, you know, why do bad things happen to good people and those kinds of things. And I think that in the fresh air right before this dialogue, you know, there was a reading of a fellow who had been left behind or left over, and was talking about his angst before a God that simply was not there or was never there, but yet I have to speak to something that seems to be larger than me. And so I think that for those, I am a person of faith, but at the same time, I have more doubts than faith. At times.
But I've heard people that I know who are deeply devout say that for them that enriches their faith, that having those doubts is a part of that experience. And they look at people who never have doubts or never have any kind of questions as maybe not being exactly on the same page. Has that been your experience as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, doubt is the seedbed of faith. I think it was Paul Tillich who said that. And so, but, you know, there's some interesting voices. Ken Wilber, are you familiar with Ken Wilber, who forges the scientific with the mystic, I think there's been those kinds of attempts. Of course, then there's Dawkins who simply says no.
That's true. And that gets to a point that I want to make, too, especially this time of year. As we approach the Christmas season, we're already deep into, I guess, what we'd call the holiday season. We're getting close to Christmas. And people decry what they feel is a drift away from the religious underpinnings of these holidays. Like the gentleman we talked about at the very top of the show, a pastor in Clarksville who's paid to have thousands of signs, yard signs printed up that say, in red and white letters, Christmas is all about Jesus. But I think that things that we associate with the holiday season, like kindness or charity or altruism, can be secular values too. And what I'm wondering is, do those concepts depend on an overt religious expression? Does Christmas really mean less to me if I'm still trying to do the best I can to make somebody else's life a little better? Mm-hmm. You know,
As a Methodist, part of our tradition is what we called Christian perfection, to be perfect in love. So my understanding is that the object of my faith is not belief. It is to love. And so I find common ground. And that's the reason I find common ground and refer to any human being as a brother or sister in that human community.
Alan, you've been waiting on the line for a little while. I'm going to turn to you for a question. Go right ahead.
Yeah. So you guys have actually touched on a lot of it. Where my concern, I suppose, or my comment is that I was raised in a family that kind of ran the gamut of possibilities of religion, of agnosticism and whatnot. And I was left to, you know, believe what I figured out for myself. Of course, my, you know, great-grandmother, devout Southern Baptist, mm-hmm, in the church every Sunday and all that kind of stuff. But as I grew, I started to feel that, and especially in light of a lot of the other things that have come up with, problems in the church and actually being, like you say, a scientist primarily. It's not that I see the Bible as the history of, essentially, the history of the Jews as, of course, as they will record it. And then the New Testament, we know that the establishment of Christianity and what we see it now with the King James, that's much later, that most of the writings of the New Testament of the Bible weren't even written down until hundreds of years after the time of Christ. I don't discount the time of Christ and his existence on the planet, but I do see a problem that the major Christian and especially the evangelical stuff, that they seem to feel that they have a monopoly on morality.
Yeah. And let me, I'm sorry, I need to truncate you right there. I am so sorry, but we're running a little short on time. But that gets to a point that we've talked about kind of through the program as well, the idea of people who maybe have a personal relationship with a deity, but they're not crazy. I think Bill Maher once said, I don't have a problem with God. It's his fan club that scares me, you know. maybe, and that again may explain why people have these kinds of questions or even in some cases reject faith outright after they've kind of grown up and developed their own personalities, their own psychology, and say, I don't want to do what my family has done. Has that been your observation too, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think we all maturate at a different level, a different time and such. And sometimes if we have the opportunity to be quite reflective on our lives, then that may pose us to take a step back. But Dr. Bruce?
I think sometimes, too, there's a temptation to look at and see religion within a single box and even a single religious denomination, when in fact there's such diversity across the spectrum within denominations and ways to do and be, and including compatibility potentially with science, and so it's... I think sometimes easy to couch religion means one single thing when in fact it doesn't. And that goes back to this rise of the unaffiliated, which I think has been a somewhat of a welcome label because in the U.S. context, Americans have a real skepticism towards labels like atheist and atheism even agnosticism, especially when you ask about polling behaviors, whether, for example, they would be willing to vote for an equally qualified candidate who was atheist. And Americans tend to bristle at that term. And yet now with this this use of the term unaffiliated or religious nun, it creates a space that is perhaps a bit more flexible around what religion means, what affiliation means, and recognizing the nuance and complexity that is something as complex and nuanced as religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to turn back to you for a minute, Bruce Spengler, on this, because as we talk about redefinition or definition of one's faith or non-belief, may include things like you don't go to church as often or engaging less with an organized body in favor of a more personal or more tailored approach, even where you might even choose how you worship based on a specific doctrine that you like as opposed to the entire thing, sort of cherry-picking a little bit here and there. As that happens and people go less to the brick-and-mortar establishment churches that we've talked about on Wednesday evenings and Sunday mornings, what then is the role of a church in a community? How do they adapt to these changing demographics as well?
Well, I think every church is really, really struggling with that. I mean, there is any institution probably deals with its own demise. And so in some ways, I mean, I was—
You're telling me I work in journalism.
Yes. I was really surprised in terms of the study that mainline denominations only represented 13%. I have to admit, I knew it was in decline. I just did not know in terms of that way. So the landscape is really, really changing. And there's all kinds of quote-unquote experts out there on church growth and those kinds of things. I think that the years to before us will reveal what it will reveal in terms of the identity or the expression of faith.
I would just add, too, that we also have to be careful in how we're defining and who we're including in terms of looking at these patterns. Because, again, if you look at first-generation immigrants especially, which constitute a big part of the United States population, then mm-hmm. those levels of participation in the brick-and-mortar institutions are higher and are huge in terms of building cultural capital, social capital, and resources for the newest Americans. And so it depends largely on which slice of America you're paying attention to and which slices are growing, which slices are shrinking. And I think that will speak to what religion looks like in the future.
Yeah. Michael in Knoxville has been on hold for a little while. And Michael, we are a little bit short on time. If you could be brief, but we'd love to hear from you.
Yes, I wanted to say that I really appreciate this discussion. And I think a lot of it revolves around the fact that we have a common human experience and we all have the same needs as each other, needs for love, security, needs to understand our identity in the world. And I think religion is a way to address those needs. And I think when people become disillusioned with what they're presented with in the religion that they've brought up with, and that's when they tend to migrate and try to meet and meet those needs. And I think that's what drives is just those common needs. And what's tragic is if people feel abandoned or left out and they don't have a way to meet those common needs for community and social support and stuff like that. And maybe technology is a way to bridge some of that gap, but people have those needs. And I think people are just stirring the pot with so much available and the internet to widen their world perspective of what's possible. There's going to be more migration to meet those common human needs that we all share in our human experience. And if there is a kind of an emergent church that's coming and evolving, I think it's going to center around the embracing of diversity and the embracing of loving people well and meeting those needs well.
Very well said.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment. And thank you for sharing that with us, Michael. As we get a little closer to the end of the hour here, I want to end with just a little look into the crystal ball, if we may, which I know for a sociologist may not be. We're getting into the realm of speculation
here. Prognosticate.
But what I'm getting at here, I think, might be an interesting topic. Anyway, we've spent most of the hour talking about what we're already observing and what has already happened in terms of shifting people numbers when it comes to faith or non-belief in Tennessee and throughout the nation. There have been other periods of ebb and flow in religiosity and religious fervor in the United States. I think particularly of the Great Awakenings of the 18th and 19th century, and we kind of ebb and then we flow and we come back. Is what we're seeing now really the beginning of a long new trend? Is it just that this is one of those cycles, or do we have enough information to really know at this point what we're looking at as we see these numbers shifting?
Well, I think one thing we know in terms of the unaffiliated is that that number is growing and in pretty substantial proportions. So I would guess that that would grow. But the thing that we cannot assume from that is that the U.S. is becoming a secular place, or that people are becoming not religious, or that the U.S. is not a religious place. I think, you know, as a sociologist of religion, sociology even has long been skeptical of the influence and role of religion, despite the persistence of empirical evidence otherwise. You know, religion continues to matter for individuals. Religion continues to matter in public life, in community. And so even as we see these things move and shape and the labels change, we, I think, will be asking different sorts of questions to better understand the role of religion, but that role will continue to be prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What will you be watching for, Bruce Spangler, as you go forward? You said a few minutes ago that only time is really going to tell what shape the role of faith may play in people's lives or in communities as we go forward. What are you going to be watching for? How do you keep an eye on this?
I think my perspective is somewhat myopic in terms of the denomination of which I am a part.
Right.
And so I am curious to see the direction of which we go and which is the potential of splintering once again. But we as Methodists have a long, long history of doing that. I think there's only about 350 odd different expressions of Methodism throughout the world.
Only that many?
Only.
Oh,
so,
gosh.
At the moment, in terms of looking for the future, I just see that I have a 3 o'clock meeting. So that's about as far as I can do for you, my friend.
You know what? That is a smart man right there, not getting too far ahead of oneself. Well, I guess the last thing that I would ask about here, how do you see religious leaders responding to some of these concerns? You said, and we got just a few minutes left, so just be brief about this, but when you see religious leaders looking at these numbers, you said churches are kind of in flux. What are some specific things that you're hearing maybe from your colleagues about, well, we're trying this or we're doing that and we're going to see how it turns out?
I think one of the things I hear most often is small groups.
Yeah.
That's much more relational. That's what I hear.
And when you say, do you mean like topical small, like based around a certain common interest?
The community is very small.
Oh, okay. All right.
There may be a large assembly occasionally, but for the most part, it's small groups.
All right. The age of customization grows,
yes.
It appears, even in religion. Well, for this final dialogue of 2015, as we do approach a period of religious holidays, a fascinating discussion on the state of faith in Tennessee in 2015. Thank you so much to the Reverend Bruce Spangler and Dr. Tricia Bruce for being with me. Thank you to all of you for calling in and sharing your questions and comments with us, and for the folks who gave us tweets and all kinds of feedback as well. You can find out more at WUOT.org, where the entirety of today's show will be posted later this afternoon. I'll be back with you on All Things Considered at 4. Right now, afternoon concert with Whitney Dodds, 91.9 FM, WUOT and WUOT HD1, Knoxville.